Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Are human beings monogamous by nature? On that question hangs an awful lot of arguments over the last several centuries. While granting our tendency to slip, most commentators and scientists seem to believe we are. According to the conventional wisdom, it's in the interest of a woman to keep a male as a protector and provider, and it's the interest of a man to provide only for his own children. In the best-selling book, Sex at Dawn, Christopher Ryan and co-author Salsita Jetha aim to answer the question, what is the essence of human sexuality and how did it get to be that way? And they contend that, quote, cultural shifts that began about 10,000 years ago rendered the true story of human sexuality so subversive and threatening that for centuries it has been silenced by religious authorities, pathologized by physicians, studiously ignored by scientists, and covered up by moralizing therapists. What is that true story? Well, according to Ryan, first, we didn't descend from apes, we are apes. They liken us most to bonobos. Further, quote, human beings evolved in intimate groups where almost everything was shared. Food, shelter, protection, childcare, even sexual pleasure. Now, needless to say, their attempt to overturn the accepted narrative on such a hot topic as sex has led to controversy. And Chris Ryan joins me this week to explore these questions and these ideas. Here in Free Forum, as you know, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, and culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. After getting his BA in literature, Christopher Ryan spent 20 years working odd jobs ranging from salmon fishing in Alaska to teaching conversational English to prostitutes in Bangkok, before earning a PhD in research psychology at Saybrook University. He hosts the podcast Tangentially Speaking at feralaudio.com and is co-author, as I said, with Salsita Jetha of Sex at Dawn, How We Mate, Why We Stray, and What It Means for Modern Relationships. Welcome, Christopher Ryan, to Free Forum.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
Thank you. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So I just did a quick bio. But could you tell us in your own words the path to the work that you're doing today? And feel free to mention, I know, it's obviously circuitous, but you would be surprised how often that's true.
Yeah.
I've never had anyone in 15 years say, well, I set out to do this and I did it.
Right.
Every success seems to be accidental, somewhat.
Yeah.
So your path, mention mentors, turning points, decisions.
Sure. You know, what happened, my father taught literature in university. My grandfather taught literature in university. My mother was an English teacher. I mean, I grew up in a house of books, right? Books everywhere. And I love books. I love novels, short stories, poetry, essays, the whole thing. I just love reading. So I was doing my undergraduate work at Hobart College in upstate New York. And it was a strange college because the student body was pretty much all sort of right wing. You know, George Bush's niece was in my class, and you know they were like Reagan.
So what years are these?
This is 80 to 84. You know, the Reagan Revolution was in full swing.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody was chasing money. It was frat boy central. But the faculty was sort of radical left wing. You know, Marxist feminist. You know, and so I ended up connecting much more with the faculty than with the student body. So like my best buddy was the head of the English department, and his really close friend was a guy named Andrew Harvey, who's the youngest person to ever be a full professor at Oxford. He was 21. He was a full don at Oxford. So I was sort of like hanging out with the professors, winning all these academic awards, you know, on the fast track to academia. And what happened was I found
– going into the family business.
Going into the family business, exactly. And I was really well connected. Andrew was going to help me get into Oxford. I was going to do a PhD there. And, you know, by the time I was 30, I'd have tenure at Princeton or whatever, and I'd be all set. So what happened was I found a loophole in the student handbook that I realized would allow me to graduate on time but skip my junior year. So I took advantage of it because my parents were paying cash for, you know, very expensive education. I was like, look, I can save you guys a year's tuition and I can go have an adventure and then I'll come back and finish up. So I hitchhiked from New York to Alaska And that's when I did the salmon fishing and the cannery gutting salmon. And but what happened during that trip, I was this pedantic little, you know, guy, little, you know, self-proclaimed genius with my collected poetry of D.H. Lawrence and my backpack and Joseph Conrad and all this stuff I loved reading. And these people who picked me up along the way, a lot of them were just unimaginably generous and kind to me. And they would take me home and let me sleep in their house. And, you know, people would pick me up and put me in the back seat with their little kids. And it was just like, why are these people so trusting and kind? And I started to see that they were not intellectuals at all, but there was a deeper kind of intelligence at work that I had not really thought about. And I ended up having like a midlife crisis at 20, you know, where I said, I look back at my friends in the university world and they were really smart people, IQ, you know, super high IQ. But if these other people had appeared in our world, they wouldn't have been met with the same sort of generosity and kindness. And I started thinking, who do I really want to be like here? You know, what kind of life do I want to have? So this created a huge, you know, schism in my life. And what happened was that summer I said, okay, look, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I don't know what I want to do with this life. And I'm too young to make a decision. So until I'm 30, I'm not going to make a commitment to anything or anyone. I'm going to take my 20s. And I remember there was a line in an essay by Robert Frost called The Shape a Poem Makes. And the line was, he says, like a piece of ice on a hot stove, a poem must ride its own melting. And I thought, I'm going to take my 20s and ride my own melting. And I'm just going to see what happens. I'm not going to go to graduate school. I'm not going to go to medical school. I'm not going to get married. I'm not going to have a career. I'm just going to float around the world, open to whatever comes my way. And so that was the path, right? And so in a way, it was sort of intentional, but it was only intentional in the broadest sense.
That, let me interrupt you for a second.
Yeah, please.
Because our experience is pretty similar.
Oh.
Yeah. And for listeners who don't know this part of my biography, I graduated Harvard in 69, which was 65 to 69 was an incredible time to be in college, and especially at certain places like Harvard, Columbia, right. Berkeley, sure. Cornell, et cetera. And I had an intense, very successful time in college, did some amazing things, helped start an alternative high school that I was the director of and helped run a camp for chronic schizophrenics. I mean, great stuff. But when it was finished, I felt, given the tenor of the times, that without the gift of those hitchhiking folks that you met, I thought, I don't want to be part of this institution, part of this large establishment. And I spent basically the next until about 73, so those years, living on communes, including a sailing commune,
oh, wow.
Organic farming, art school in Mexico, living out of my van, McGovern campaign, etc. There was this period right at that same period where I just moved from thing to thing and then, you know, later sharpened it back up. The thing that surprised me about your biography actually was the point, and if there's something you want to put in before you get to this, was the point that you actually do go back and get a master's and a PhD, because that was the thing that sort of I didn't do but surprised me about why – what led you to that?
Yeah.
Oh, let me just tell people,
by
the way.
Sure.
I'm Terrence McNally. You're listening to Free Forum. And I'm speaking with Christopher Ryan. We're going to talk about his book, Sex at Dawn, How We Mate, Why We Stray, and What It Means for Modern Relationships. And to learn more about Christopher's work, you can go to sexatdawn.com. And you can also check out Ryan's podcast at feralaudio.com. That's F-E-R-A-L-A-U-D-I-O, feralaudio.com. And then just, you know, look for Christopher Ryan.
Yeah. It's also on iTunes and at Chris Ryan, PhD.
Oh, okay.
A new site I've just set
up. Oh, okay, because that one I didn't even find.
Yeah, that one's brand new. Yeah, well, I you know, following this sort of intentionally winding path, I set off around the world, traveled all around the world, had all sorts of crazy adventures, and ended up in Barcelona And the reason I was in Barcelona was because I was robbed there the first night. I'd never been robbed anywhere. First night in Barcelona, I had my bag stolen, passport, everything. So while I was waiting for a new passport, someone offered me a job and someone else offered me a room in their place. And I started meeting some pretty interesting women. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just hang out here for the winter, right? That was 89. So I've sort of been based there ever since. I've left and returned, and right. You know, but that's been my base. So from that, you know, one of the lessons is never assume an experience is bad until you see how it plays out down the road. You know, getting robbed might be a good thing.
Right.
Anyway, what happened was I was, you know, I got to, where was I, mid-30s or so, and, you know, I'd passed the deadline, you know, for
– for getting back to Hofstra.
For doing something, yeah. And I was getting frustrated because I was teaching English. I was doing some translating and whatever. And I was living well, you know, but it wasn't adding up to anything. And you get to an age in life where you start to say, you know, what – getting another stamp on my passport isn't really doing it for me anymore, right? And I went to – in Scotland, what's the –
Findhorn?
Yeah, Findhorn, exactly. There you go. So I went to Findhorn, again, hitchhiking through England, which I would not recommend to anyone because nobody picks you up. But I got to Findhorn, and I just wanted to see the place because I'd read about it in The Secret Life of Plants, amazing book. And so I was there at Loch Ness in that area, and I just said, I'm going to go check this place out. So I went there and was walking around, and I saw there was an office, you know, sorry, information office. And I went in there, and there was a woman in there, and she said, what are you doing? And, yeah, I'm just hanging out, you know. She said, are you going to do some courses? I said, oh, no, I can't afford to do any courses, you know, and I'm just hitchhiking through, passing through. And she said, well, do you have time? And you have some? I said, well, yeah, I'm, you know, whatever. And she said, well, then just sit down and write on this paper who you are, what you're doing, where you are in your life, and let me see what I can do. So I wrote a little thing, and she came back a couple hours later and said, okay, you're invited 1 week, all expenses paid, you know, but you can't live in your tent. You got to live in the place with the other people, and you do your, you know, a morning in the gardens, another morning in the kitchen.
Yeah,
and
so you're in your keep.
You get to, yeah. Well, not really, yeah. But you get to see the way the whole thing works, and you do these classes and meet other people and all that. And it was transformative. It was fantastic. And one of the things that happened was I met people who had a PhD in psychology who were not watching rats in mazes. Right. And I always thought a PhD in psychology was behavioral, you know, analytical, you know, either very clinical or very quantitative. And I saw these people who, you know, they had a PhD, but they were doing really interesting stuff. And that opened up a door like, wow, because I knew I wanted to do something with my mind. And the way to get recognition and paid for that is to have letters after your name. So then I sat down in the middle of the night. A couple months later, and I wrote a letter to someone you might actually know, Andrew Weil.
Sure.
Who was at Harvard, yeah. I think around the same time you were.
Yeah. And I met him for the first time then. He was at the med school studying marijuana and so on, legally at the time, and have met him on over the years and so on.
Right.
Yeah.
So I wrote him a letter because I really admired his writing, and I admired the way he managed to combine multicultural perspectives in the medical model. So if you've got a chronic skin condition, he might consult an Ayurvedic approach or Chinese, or if you have a stress condition, he might look into yoga, or maybe, you know, it's like,
yeah.
But if you had a car accident, go to the hospital,
right.
You know what
right.
I mean? So he picks and chooses from these different traditions. I wrote him a letter in the middle of the night. This is long before email. This must have been 91, 92, something like that. And, you know, out of the blue, and I just said, look, I admire your work. I admire this multicultural approach you take. And I'd sort of like to do something like that with psychology, I think, because I've been traveling around the world. I'm very interested in the way different cultures approach these universal human concerns, like altered states of consciousness, like sexuality, you know, what have you. And that's, you know, can you recommend a grad school? Can you recommend things to read? Whatever. I didn't think I'd ever hear from
him. Right.
The guy gets hundreds of letters from desperate people, you know, with medical issues, I'm sure. And a couple weeks later, I got home and there was a message on my answering machine. hey, Chris, this is Andy Weil. I got your letter, blah, blah, blah. Give me a call sometime. Here's my home number. I couldn't believe it. A, because he was so generous. B, because I hadn't included my phone number in the letter. He'd called Spanish information and got my phone number. So anyway, one of the things he recommended was a school in San Francisco called CIIS, California Institute of Integral Studies. I went out there. I ended up moving to San Francisco, took a few courses there. Then I found out about Saybrook and went on and did my PhD at Saybrook. So he was an important figure.
I mean, that's such a wonderful story, you know, in terms of A, following an impulse which you know is sort of a mad impulse, that is to write Andy Weil, like that's how I'll solve this problem.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And then having that rewarded so specifically, so intentionally. It's wonderful. I'm Terrence McNally. The other voice is Christopher Ryan, and right now we're talking about how he got to the position where he ended up writing the book we're going to talk about, which is Sex at Dawn, How We Mate, Why We Stray, and What It Means for Modern Relationships. There's three websites I'll point you to. One is sexatdawn.com. The other is Christopher Ryan.
Chris Ryan,
PhD.
.com.
And then he has a podcast called Tangentially Speaking, which is at feralaudio.com. It's also findable at iTunes. Okay, so you want to bring this comprehensive sort of approach to psychology, multicultural, et cetera, do you originally know that you're going to focus on sexuality or not?
No. At that point, I was very interested in shamanism and altered states of consciousness. I did work with MAPS, multidisciplinary.
Sure. I've had MAPS folks, Charles Grobe.
Charles Grobe. I interviewed him for Tangentially Speaking.
I know you did.
Wonderful guy.
Yeah.
So I was very interested in that. And I went to the first World Ecstasy Conference at the Dead Sea Hyatt in Israel, sponsored by MAPS, and they invited me to interpret for a Spanish scientist who was there, who has since become a good friend. And so I was very interested in that. But you know, I think the reason I was so interested in altered states of consciousness was the same reason I'm very interested in sexuality, which I hinted at earlier, which is that these are universal phenomena that all people in all cultures experience, but we interpret them in different ways. For example, talking about psychedelics, every culture that's ever had access to psychedelic plants has seen them as the greatest gift of the gods, except us.
Yeah.
Where we throw people in prison longer for selling mushrooms than for second-degree murder. What's that mean? You know, there's something really interesting about, 99.9% versus, boom, us. You know, how does that?
And by the way, when you say us, how broad is us? Because America has such an influence with the drug legal laws and so on, their attitude has spread to a lot of Western Europe, hasn't it?
Well, particularly since the Reagan administration in Asia, in Thailand, because a lot of foreign aid is tied into them following the line. But we see
– following the line on drugs and on birth control.
Yeah. Well, Casilda, my wife and co-author, worked in Mozambique in the early 80s, and she did research for the World Health Organization on sexuality. And she ran straight into that problem because the funding depended upon them using condoms as a way to combat AIDS. But if anyone who's lived and worked in that part of Africa knows, nobody's got money to buy condoms and nobody uses condoms. So it was condoms and monogamy. And, you know, she's like, I grew up here. You're not going to convince these people to be sexually monogamous. It's just not part of their reality, nor are the condoms. So, you know, you've got to take a different approach. There was no other approach available or allowed. Yeah. So I was very interested in the consciousness as a way to tease out this difference between culture and human, right? An individual. So we've got these three different parameters that are intersecting.
What's nature, what's culture, and then what's individual,
and what's just
subjective.
You. Yeah. And then, you know, I sort of and that's how I met Stanley Krippner, who was is a professor at Stanford or at
Saybrook.
I wish it were Stanford.
Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. And we got to be good friends. And then when I got more interested in the what happened with the sexuality was that it was Clinton really that led me into that. Because I was casting about for topics for a PhD dissertation. At that point, I'd done most of the coursework. And Clinton and Lewinsky thing was happening. And I was thinking, like, how is it possible if men have controlled all the levers of power since the beginning of time, military, economic, physical, whatever, how did men design a world in which the most powerful man in that world is publicly humiliated for doing something most men would do? You know, like no strings attached, sexual encounter, your wife doesn't seem to mind. Why not? Right. He does that and suddenly it's a huge hubbub. And, you know, Gingrich, the hypocrite in chief, is leading the charge while he's also cheating on his wife. It was like, what is going on here? So I read a book called The Moral Animal by Robert Wright, which is a beautiful book, a very well written summation of the Darwinian, the sort of neo-Darwinian view of human sexual evolution. And it's beautifully designed because you'll have one chapter that's theory, and then the next chapter is biographical sketches from Darwin's life that illustrate the theory from the previous chapter. So it's very good reading.
Yeah, Robert has been a guest on here many times.
Oh, okay.
One of the big thinkers.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely, and such a convincing writer. So I read that book and loved it, and then I started proselytizing. Now, at the time, I was working for a nonprofit group called Women in Community Service in San Francisco. There were 50 women and me, basically. So I was surrounded by all these really smart, articulate women. And so when I laid out this thing to them, which we later called the standard narrative in our book, you know, men trade their resources for the fidelity of the woman so that the genetic, you know, the paternity certainty and all that. These women were like, yeah, you know, that sounds like a very Victorian male vision of human sexuality. That's not really how we're experiencing this. And so, okay, I don't know. So I went back out of respect for these women. I went back and looked at the original research that Wright was referring to. And that's when I found bonobos. I'm like, interesting. He didn't really mention bonobos much. You know, it's just an offhand mention. And then he went on. But bonobos are equally relevant to human evolution as chimpanzees are. But there are all kinds of references to chimps and very little about bonobos. Interesting. Then I started finding cultures in which paternity was not only not an issue, but there seemed to be it was an issue, but in the opposite sense, there seemed to be rituals built into the society to intentionally obscure paternity.
So children exist in this tribe and we don't know who the father is.
You can't possibly know who the father is because there are seasonal rituals in which you cannot have sex with your normal partners, punishable by death in some of these cases. Or societies, and there are a dozen of them in the Amazon and scattered around other parts of the world, that believe that a fetus is literally composed of accumulated semen. So a woman who wants to have a kid who's smart and funny and good looking will make sure she has sex with the smart guy, the funny guy, and the good looking guy to get the essence of all these different men into her baby. And then when the child's born, the three different men will all acknowledge their paternity. So paternity is not seen as something that can only be with one man. It's seen as something that can be shared among several. So there are all these sorts of things. And I felt like I was pulling on a thread and suddenly the whole tapestry started to come apart.
Mm. So the standard narrative tapestry.
The standard narrative, right. And I started to see how deeply political it is as opposed to scientific. How everyone, including Darwin and me, chooses the evidence that fits their preconceived biases. And, you know, and I, as I say, I'm one of them. Things jump out. When I read that partible paternity stuff, that was like, boom, a bomb went off, you know, because that fit my sense. And the other thing I should say, on a personal level, all those years traveling around the world, you know, I was doing a bit of personal research in human sexuality across cultures, right? And I was seeing, like, one of the things I was seeing was that female sexual pleasure is immense. There's an immense response sexually among women when they feel safe, when they feel protected, when there's not shame holding them down. And when you look at this research, what you see is a lot of over 90% of the research in human sexuality is based on American undergraduates.
It's funny you say that. I was having a conversation just recently with someone who does work in positive psychology. Mm-hmm. And just in, you know, how do you research happiness? How do you research these things that I said, isn't it the truth that most psychological studies, the subjects are college students or grad students, because that's who's around.
Right.
That's who'll give you an hour for $5. That's who can come in at any time and do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And she said that it's becoming less so, but that for years,
yeah,
absolutely. So if one looks at psychological research from, say, the 50s to maybe the 90s,
yeah,
you gotta put that asterisk by it, that it was really,
yeah,
done in a very small group. Yeah. We're at about the halfway point. Mm-hmm. So let me tell people. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Christopher Ryan about the ideas in his book. We're just getting to them. Sex at Dawn, How We Mate, Why We Stray, and What It Means for Modern Relationships, co-authored with Casilda Jetta. To learn more, go to sexatdawn.com or ChrisRyanPhD.com. And Chris also has podcasts at feralaudio.com or iTunes. Okay. So we're just about up to where you're about to embark on this book. Yes?
Yeah, sort of.
I know.
Sort of. What happened was, so I did my dissertation on human sexual behavior in prehistory, A Challenge to the Darwinian View, I think was the subtitle. And now, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a writer by biologically,
right,
you know, who I sort of like got the scientific credentials.
So that you could write.
So I could write
about science.
Yeah, exactly. With some credibility. Most science writers are scientists who learn to write. You know, some of them very
some
well.
Of them very
Oliver
well.
Sacks, for example,
yeah,
you know, one of the best. Andrew Weil,
yeah,
I would say, somewhere in there.
Well, actually, an awful lot of John Brockman's clients, if you,
yeah,
know what I'm talking
edge,
about, the folks,
yeah,
who are at the edge,
yeah,
where, I mean, some people have pointed out that science to the public is a phenomenon of the last 15, 20 years that, hmm, that didn't exist in this stage. But,
yeah,
because there are a number of good writers who do science now, or, you know,
yeah,
it's changed. Go ahead.
Lewis Thomas,
sure,
Lives of a Cell. Oh, my God, what a great book. Anyway, so what happened was, so when I was working on my dissertation, you know, this is fun stuff. This is, you know, juicy.
Juicy,
yeah,
exactly.
Juicy material. So I would, you know, get a little creative and throw in a, you know, a little irony, a little, you know, and a little nuance. And every time my professors on the committee would cross it out, and in the margin they wrote, save it for the book. Which at the time I was like, oh, come on, you know, give me a break here. Let me, no, just dry facts. We don't want to, you know, don't get cute with us, right? So, you know, I did think, like, you know, if this is true, if I'm right, this is pretty big.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, and it's funny to look back on this. The dissertation was easy compared to the book, because the dissertation, all I had to do was convince three people,
mm,
right? And I knew where they were coming from. So as long as I was solid in their areas of expertise,
right,
I was fine. But the book, that goes out into the world, right? So I thought, okay, I would like to make this a book, but I need to really – I'm going to get attacked from five different angles with this. So I need to know a lot more than I do now about primatology, about anthropology, about archaeology, about human physiology and anatomy, about contemporary psychosexual research. I need to really know that stuff, all five of those fields, like a PhD in any one of those fields would, in order to be able to defend this idea.
Well, especially because, and I'm sure this is in your thinking, you're not just adding the latest iteration of what's already out there.
Exactly.
You are attacking, subverting,
right,
the conventional ongoing thing, with a little bit of all of these feels.
Right, yeah.
And they're going to come after you.
Of course they will, and as they should. I mean, that's the scientific process. So I need – and also I don't want to be humiliated. I don't want to, you know, publish something and have somebody go, excuse me, you haven't considered the gorilla, you know. Like,
yeah.
So between that sort of caution and my natural proclivity to procrastinate – it was probably 7 years or something until I got around to actually sitting down and saying, okay, I'm going to do this. The idea was to release the book in 2009, which was the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth. And when I initially pitched the book, it was called What Darwin Didn't Know About Sex. And it was sort of going to be modeled after Robert Wright's mm-hmm. book, where I would use Darwin's sexual biography as a way to show how his lack of experience, at least breadth of experience with different women, different cultures, whatever, misinformed some of his understanding of human sexuality. But the different publishers who ended up actually being interested in the book all convinced me that
that's too narrow.
Too narrow, yeah.
That'll get you the Darwin fans, and it'll get you
– and it'll get them angry at me too.
That's right.
Yeah. So we broadened it out a lot. And then by that point, I had met Casilda, who's, you know, talking about my attraction to multiculturalism. She's an half Indian, half Persian, who was raised in a Muslim Hindu family in Mozambique, Africa. So she looks Indian. She's got an African soul. Then because of the Civil War, she was sent off to Portugal when she was 13. So her
– European.
Her education is European, yeah, MD from Portugal. Then just after getting her MD, she went back to Mozambique and worked as the only doctor in an area of 50,000 inhabitants about the size of Delaware. And she just drove in a pickup truck from village to village treating whatever she found. So she's this amazing – she like diagnoses you by looking at your tongue and smell your breath that kind of – you know.
Yeah.
She's from another world. So she informed my thinking on all these issues so much that you know, English is her sixth language. So I wrote the book.
Right. For listeners, the book is – if you look at the cover of the book, Christopher Ryan and Casilda Jetha. And I asked, could she join us? And Christopher said two things. One, they're moving this week to Vancouver, and he's sneaking out to do this. But the other was that basically, English being only one of her languages, it was part of an agreement that she exactly. could be co-author if you'd handle the media.
That was her condition, yeah. And also, she's a psychiatrist. She's a private person. And she – you know, when I'd written the manuscript, and she was running a mental hospital, and she'd come home every day, and the first thing she would do after, you know, an incredibly taxing day is sit down and read what I'd written and give me wonderful feedback, honest, sometimes very uncomfortably honest feedback, which, as you know, is exactly what you need. And then, so by the time I thought, I was getting to the end and I was thinking, how am I going to acknowledge her, you know, the beginning, you know, to my wife, blah, blah, blah. What am I going to say? Anything that was even close to sufficient was cheesy, and everything else was just so far from sufficient. And I thought, this whole book is about sharing, about, you know, non-zero sum thinking, another Robert Wright book. And I thought, you know, this book wouldn't exist without her.
Yeah.
And she is a co-author, right? She didn't sit down and write it, but she's a co-author. Her thoughts, her experience have informed every page of this thing. And so in the morning, I was so proud of myself. You know, I thought, I'm going to – and in the morning, I told her, and she was angry. I couldn't believe it. She was like, absolutely not. This is your work. You've done, you know, da-da-da. And so then a couple days later, I came back to her and I said, you know, I mean, it's honest. You have been part of this. And more people will probably read the book if there's a woman's name and your beautiful multicultural face and your medical degree. It adds another dimension that'll bring more people, you know, more attention to it. That convinced her.
Tell you what, we've got 18 minutes left.
Okay, let's go.
The conventional narrative is basically hangs on two things, right?
Right.
That women choose men for and men choose women for.
So men choose women for their fertility and their indications of fidelity, and women choose men for their resources.
And why those two things? Because?
Well, this is the conventional view, right?
And then we're going to...
Essentially, women needed the men for their protection, for their status, for the shelter, for the meat, for the things that they would bring, because the women are vulnerable when they're pregnant and nursing and so on, and they can't go out and hunt and protect themselves and do all these things for themselves.
And the men?
And the men need... they don't want to make an investment in someone else's genetic legacy. So the men need the fidelity because the man's saying, hey, I don't want to, invest my time and effort and resources in someone else's kids. So I need to make sure you are not having sex with anyone else.
Okay. Now, that has been, if you go back to Hobbes, for instance, who you jump off from, who says that, what's the quote?
Before the state, life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short.
Right. And basically that kind of view of pre-civilization, pre-agriculture has kind of been passed on from one to the next. And your research tells you that up until agriculture, things were very different. How so?
Yeah, up until agriculture – now, keep in mind, when people talk about the EEA, the Environment of Evolutionary Adaptedness, which is sort of built into a lot of these discussions, that's a misnomer because there is no one environment. People lived in different parts of the world. The things happened geologically. Volcanoes erupted that changed the climate for years. Different ice ages, the sea level rising and falling. So it was... the world was always in flux and has always been in flux in one way or another. So there is no one, savanna.
Right.
But having said that, there are universal traits of immediate return hunter-gatherer societies wherever they're found.
And what you just said, immediate return hunter-gatherer societies were the norm pre-agriculture all over.
Everywhere.
Right.
Because, that's the way animals live and we are an animal. And – so our ancestors were not cultivating. They were moving around from one source of food to another. And when they'd overhunted the rabbits or whatever in one area, they just moved down the beach or wherever they were going. And the world was a pretty empty place, right? 70,000 years ago, there were about 3,000 breeding human beings on the planet. Genetic research has shown that.
And the groups they were in were how big?
The groups generally didn't get beyond 150 people. This is based on research by Robin Dunbar. 150 is called Dunbar's number in honor of his research. He's found that that's about the number of people that any of us can keep track of. In an immediate sense,
and
actually,
so the reason that we wanted to keep it that small, or it tended to stay that small, was that basically these little groups moved around, and trust was based on the fact that there were no strangers,
right? And everyone personally. So when you get above 150, people start to become abstractions. And that changes our behavior toward one another. When, I would never – if your wallet's on the table, I would never think of taking money out of it, right? But if you're some nameless, faceless corporation and you undercharge me in a bill, well, maybe I won't point it out to you. It's a different thing. So this is very important when we consider not just sexual issues but political issues, economic issues, questions of warfare, violence, all these sort of questions about human nature, all these different dimensions.
That's right. And the point you just made to bring up human nature is to remember that when we say human nature, what you mean is not just, hey, that's the way we are. It's that it's in our nature versus that it's a culturally determined trait.
Right.
And that's really
right.
What we're talking about is the difference between those two. So in these immediate return hunter-gatherer forager societies, these small groups that moved around, no one was a stranger. And you say life was egalitarian.
Not only I say that, pretty much every anthropologist who studied these people would concur with that. The thing about these societies is that because people are so interdependent, the worst thing that can happen is for schisms to develop within that group, right? And the best way to start to develop schisms is to have differences in, you know, power, in autonomy, in resources, and so on. If you, you know, like, for example, you're talking about the standard narrative, right? The standard narrative posits that a guy goes out, kills a deer, comes back and says, okay, I'm going to share this meat with my woman and our children. And sorry, rest of you, you know, too bad.
Good luck out hunting.
Yeah, go get your own. Now, this presumes a sort of nuclear family prehistoric suburbia where people were living in their little, you know, houses independently. That's not the way these people live anywhere. In fact, what happens if you kill a deer, you bring it back, or you don't even bring it back because there are so many rituals involved in making sure nobody gets proud. So you might bring it and leave it outside the village and mention to someone else that it's there, and someone else will go and bring it in so nobody knows who killed it. Men will exchange their arrows so that you can't even identify from the arrow who killed a particular animal, right? So there are all sorts of things built into many of these societies that show how consciously they were avoiding the sorts of status accumulation that the standard narrative
depends
on. Exactly.
Right. Okay, so everything's egalitarian. What you point out is you're sharing food, you're sharing childcare, you're sharing sexual pleasure. To
right.
What extent and how much does this vary?
What varies a lot. And of course, what we're looking at is societies, immediate return hunter-gatherer societies.
That still exist.
That still exist.
That's right. In other words,
right.
We cannot research those 3,000 people that right. existed in the past.
Yeah, by the way, I should, just to be accurate, the 3,000 people, that was because of the Toba explosion 70,000 years ago, which wiped out most of humankind.
Ah, okay. So yeah. That was
a bottleneck.
The retraction, and then we're starting again. But so what you look at now is surviving tribes and peoples that
right.
live the same way, and this is what we find.
That's one of the sources of information that we use in the book. Now, of course, you can argue, well, come on, how can you know? They've been evolving. Just, you know, they're not a model of the past. They live in the present just like we do. They're also affected by disease. You know, nobody is untouched in the world by Western civilization. They've been marginalized. So who knows how accurate that is? That's a legitimate point in any of these sorts of discussions. But we look at many other sources of information, one of which is the human anatomy.
Right. So now human anatomy and this relationship or comparison to chimps and bonobos.
Right. What one of the most powerful indications of the sexual behavior of our ancestors is simply looking at the fact that human beings have external testicles and the size of those testicles compared to the body, the overall body. There are other things too, the size of the male compared to the female and so on. Now, all these things line up differently in different mating scenarios. So you've got gorillas, for example, who after chimps and bonobos are the next closest relation
to
humans.
So just to be clear, we are closest to chimps and bonobos
right.
and sort of equally close to both?
Exactly, equally close to both.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then next is gorillas.
The best way to think of the relation is like I've got twin brothers, right? One's chimps, one's a bonobo. They're very closely related to each other, but after each other, next comes me.
Okay.
Right? So that's why they're equally relevant to any discussion of the primate origins of whatever.
And very different.
Quite different. Yeah, although they look very similar, their behavior is extremely different, particularly in terms of sexuality and politics, power relations.
Sharing and politics.
Franz Duval, who's probably the world's best known expert on chimps and bonobos, other than Jane Goodall perhaps, has said that chimps use violence to get sex and bonobos use sex to avoid violence. So that's sort of chimps are male dominated, bonobos are female dominated.
And why the differences? Do we know?
Well, there are theories. The best known theory, which I think is Richard Wrangham at Harvard, proposed that the difference is that chimps and bonobos were probably one species. And about a million years ago, the Congo River shifted its course and cut that group into two. The chimps are on the north side of the river where the gorillas also are. And they compete for some – there's some overlap in the foods that they eat. So there's some competition there. Whereas the bonobos were on the south side. There are no gorillas, so they had less competition for resources. The problem with that theory is that according to classic Darwinian logic, the bonobos would have quickly saturated the environment and then had the competition with each
other.
Oh, among
themselves, yeah.
Right. So it doesn't really make sense, but that's
the
theory people are using.
And what do you, why do you say we're more similar to bonobos?
Well, our sexual behavior is extremely similar. You know, if you look at chimps, a female chimp will never let another female chimp or much less male chimp hold her baby. Bonobos, shortly after giving birth, come back, join the group, and they let other bonobos hold the baby. That's something human beings do. We give our babies to strangers in the grocery store. You know, it's amazing. Our sexual behavior, bonobos are the only other mammal that has sex face to face. They look in each other's eyes. They kiss. They kiss each other's hands. They hold hands. They have lots of same-sex interactions. They have, in fact, every possible combination other than mother-son. That's the only not witnessed. I was going to say taboo, but that's not the right way to think of it. The bonobos are also very susceptible to stress. One example of that is in World War II, there were some bonobos and chimps in two separate enclosures in near Dresden. And the bombing in Dresden didn't hit the zoo at all, but there was a lot of noise and chaos. All the bonobos died and none of the chimps did.
So
just from the stress.
Vulnerability to trauma.
Yeah.
So that's the voice of Christopher Ryan. We're getting right to the end here of talking about the ideas in his book, Sex at Dawn, How We Mate, Why We Stray, and what it means for modern relationships. What does this mean for modern relationships?
Different things to different people. That I have to tell you, I didn't pick that subtitle. You know, the book is not prescriptive. And in fact, when I give talks, you know, public, I think I mentioned this at TED the month ago, when, you know, I try to say, look, monogamy might not come naturally to our species, but there's lots of individual variation. For some people, it does come naturally. For most of us, it's a challenge.
A challenge.
But that doesn't mean there's something wrong with it. It's, to me, it's like vegetarianism. It can be very ethical. You know, it can be a wonderful
way. Very healthy.
Healthy, economical, you know, morally superior. But just because you've decided to become a vegetarian, don't expect that bacon will suddenly stop smelling good, right? So that's how I feel about monogamy. It's not that it's wrong or you shouldn't do it. It's that you should understand that it may be challenging for both of you. And, you know, build some compassion and some understanding into your relationship.
Let me say, and we're really racing here towards the end. I think everyone does understand that it's a challenge, I think. So what you're saying is a little – one step further than that, isn't it? Isn't it saying kind of it's not your fault?
Exactly. Yeah. I was on an interview recently and the guy who's interviewing me called me a shame exorcist. And I said, I'll accept that. I love that. Yeah. Yeah. It's not your fault. Now, it is your fault if you're going to lie and cheat and run around. You know, that's a decision you're making that I'm not supporting. But I think it was Schopenhauer who said – we can choose what we do, but not what we want to do, right? That's the crux of the issue there. So, you know, what you choose to do with this information is up to you and your partner or partners or whomever. But the information, in my understanding, is accurate. And you're right. People do understand that marriage is a challenge, but I think –
Or that monogamy is
monogamy, long-term monogamy. But I think there's a lot of – bias built into the cultural view that says if you aren't willing to commit, there's something wrong with you. You're immature. You have issues with your mother.
Commitment-phobic, yeah,
right.
All that, right?
Right. So there, you know, even though we know it can be work, I don't think on a cultural level we acknowledge why that our natural trajectory is going in a different direction.
And that direction is?
That direction is that sexuality for human beings is not about reproduction. We have sex. We are together with bonobos, getting back to the earlier point. Bonobos and humans have sex close to 1,000 times per birth. That's unheard of for mammals. Most mammals only have sex when the female's ovulating. It's very, you know, goal-directed. We have sex when the female – humans have sex when the female is – already pregnant. She's postmenopausal. She's menstruating. She's lactating. You know, it doesn't matter. Not to mention same-sex encounters and all the different configurations.
All those things that don't have anything to do with reproduction.
Exactly.
Yes.
So that's we have sex for social reasons, not reproductive
reasons. We've got to bring the conversation to a close. What I want people to realize is getting to this last nitty-gritty of what we're talking about, that at this moment when folks are trying to legislate based on enforcing monogamy,
right,
enforcing, say, whether it's the church or right-wingers, that unless it's for reproduction, it's bad, you know, even arguing that at the Supreme Court. This, I think, is a healthy thing to look into. Sex at Dawn by Christopher Ryan and Casilda Jetha. It really turns on its head much of what has been accepted about human sexuality. So again, Sex at Dawn, the website, sexatdawn.com or chrisryanphd.com or his podcasts at feralaudio.com or iTunes. Thank you, Christopher Ryan. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes or at my site. For podcast articles and transcripts and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, including looking at my work with story and narrative in organizations, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, and usually three or four articles of background, you can sign up at my site or by emailing me at temcnally, temcnally, at mac.com. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, and Mark Maxwell in production. And to you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week.